Ms. Marilyn Soulforce Politics, Episode 026.
I believe that we are waking up from the spell.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of Ms. Marilyn Soulforce Politics. I'm your host, Heather Mazier. Few have inspired me more in public life than Robert F. Kennedy. Imagination, courage, and determination. Justice, fairness, and equality. Compassion mixed with toughness and discipline. He promoted unity over division. He encouraged dissent to strengthen conviction. His heart was in charge, and it led him to personally witness and uplift the despair, hopes, and dreams of America's unfinished business in forgotten pockets of the nation, from Native American reservations to the fields of migrant farm workers, from urban blight to rural hunger. Bobby Kennedy reflected the consciousness of our best selves. He practiced Soulforce Politics.
What has violence ever accomplished? What has it ever created? No martyr's cause has ever been stilled by an assassin's bullet. No wrongs have ever been righted by riots and civil disorders. A sniper is only a coward, not a hero. And an uncontrolled or uncontrollable mob is only the voice of madness, not the voice of the people. Among free men, said Abraham Lincoln, there can be no successful appeal from the ballot to the bullet. And those who take such appeal are sure to lose their case and pay the cost. Violence breeds violence. Repression breeds retaliation. And only a cleansing of our whole society can remove this sickness from our souls. For there is another kind of violence, slower, but just as deadly destructive as the shot or the bomb in the night. This is the violence of institutions, indifference, inaction, and decay. This is the violence that afflicts the poor, that poisons relations between men because their skin has different colors. This is the slow destruction of a child by hunger and schools without books and homes without heat in the winter. This is the breaking of a man's spirit by denying him the chance to stand as a father and as a man amongst other men. But we can perhaps remember, if only for a time, that those who live with us are our brothers, and surely we can begin to work a little harder to bind up the wounds among us and to become in our hearts brothers and countrymen once again.
50 years ago, we lost Bobby Kennedy to an assassin's bullet when he was shot after winning the Democratic presidential primary in California on June 5, 1968. Fortunately, words themselves never die. And in his book, RFK, His Words for Our Times, author Rick Allen collects, edits, and introduces us to the core of Robert Kennedy's work through the use of his own words from testimony and speeches Kennedy gave in his short but profound career in public service. In today's show, we speak with Rick Allen about this book, Bobby Kennedy's life and contributions to public policy, political thought, and the imagination of what can still be accomplished to live up to our country's greatest calling, the belief that we can always aspire to be a better, more perfect union, where equality and justice for all are the cornerstones of our democracy. And just a reminder that if you enjoy our programming, please consider showing us your gratitude and support by becoming a monthly sponsor at any giving level that is comfortable for you. Our sustainers help us plan our work around consistent financial support for our podcast production costs. Visit our website at www.mizmaryland.org/donate. Thanks for listening, and I hope that you'll be inspired to read this incredible book and find the Bobby Kennedy that resides in your own heart's desire to act for good in the world. RFK's words are most definitely a timeless call to action, and we need his wise guidance now more than ever. Rick Allen, author of RFK, His Words for Our Times. Welcome to Soul Force Politics.
Thank you. So good to be with you.
It's been 50 years since we lost Robert Kennedy to the tragic events that happened that night at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, California. Yet his life's work and his words are still so resonant today. Is there something specific about this moment that is a reflection of the turbulent 1960s? Or is Robert Kennedy forever timeless and always relevant? Or maybe it's a little bit of both?
I think it is a little bit of both. And one can only judge by how the last 50 years have gone. I think Robert Kennedy's been enormously resonant with the times through, obviously, the turbulent 60s, as you said, but all the years since. And I think increasingly so now. I was really struck as I was putting together this edition of the book that the words, which were always beautiful, and the policies, which always mattered and seemed to give direction to where the country could go, were even more so now. Our times are every bit as polarized and, frankly, less violent. And so the opportunity to re-examine the man and what he stood for, his vision for America, I found extremely powerful, and I expect it will be powerful. And part of it, and we'll talk about it today, is really the difference between Kennedy's sense of American exceptionalism and the way it's defined so often today.
Reading your book, I was continually struck by how many of the problems that Robert Kennedy was seeking to fix, the division between the races, impact of poverty, marginalization of the have-nots, urban blight, rural hunger, gun violence, all of it, and so much more that he attempted to advance is still with us in varying degrees and is asking more of each of us to make Kennedy's vision a reality. Do you think that it's that these problems have just been too big to fix, or is it that we haven't had a Robert Kennedy with us to get it done?
Well, you hit on a number of really important aspects of this. First, these are extremely complex problems. If they weren't, in all likelihood, they would have been fixed. Second, and this is the concept of American exceptionalism that I wanted to mention, that's usually defined as the notion that the United States is somehow special and represents the achievement of perfection. I think Robert Kennedy, who is deeply patriotic, believed that we had never achieved our ideals. We probably never would. But the importance of American exceptionalism is that uniquely as a country, we have in each generation strive to accomplish that, and that the process is important. And the optimism should be on the effort that each of us put in as individuals, and you pointed to this, to try to get closer to our ideals. Many of us, since Robert Kennedy's death, have looked for the next Robert Kennedy. And I think that is unfair to today's candidates, and unfair to us, and unfair in its own way to Robert Kennedy. If you take a look at his work, if you read through his speeches, and again, that's the reason for this book, throughout he emphasizes the ability of individuals to make change. And the whole notion of ripples of hope, which is a phrase from his 1966 speech in Cape Town, is that each of us may be a small pebble, relatively speaking, but that collectively those ripples of hope magnify and aggregate and become a mighty current. That's the notion of American democracy, and that really is the essential optimism of Robert Kennedy, and it suggests to me we should stop looking for the next Robert Kennedy, and we should start incorporating that and being the next us.
That is so resonant to me and the work that we're doing at Soul Force Politics and reminding people that we all have an opportunity to create transformation around us. that it is upon us. It doesn't work to just give our power over to an elected representative and expect them to do all the work. It really is collective work that we are being called to that is the consciousness of America itself. That's what democracy is.
Yes.
Is for this alive notion. You know, to me, democracy isn't just something that got created after the American Revolutionary War and the coming together and drafting of the Constitution. It's an alive consciousness of who do we want to be as a nation. And even as our forefathers were writing this document saying that all men are created equal, they were not treating everyone equally. We're always needing to be that which we know we can aspire towards. We're constantly being called to being greater than which we are right now. But the way to that is always through our collective action and intention. And in the latter years of Robert Kennedy's work, he spoke quite often about the importance of community and rebuilding community and how much that had been lost during the years of his public life. Do you have some comments about his relationship to encouraging community engagement?
I think there are two notions inherent in what you indicated. The first is a sense of individual initiative, and the second is collective action and community control and community action. As to the first, individual initiative, I think it came out of Robert Kennedy's sense of activism and the role of individuals in a democracy. He said that in a democracy, the proudest title is that of citizen. And that really was fundamental to his belief system. He put it a different way, and this is at the University of Mississippi Law School in March of 1966. He said, each of us will ultimately be judged and will ultimately judge himself on the extent to which he personally contributed to the life of this nation and to world society of the kind we are trying to build. That's the notion of individual responsibility and individual initiative. The collective action goes back to that amplifying sense of ripples of hope. And he noted, particularly throughout his Senate years and the brief 1968 presidential campaign, the various forces in modern society that even then were swamping the individual. Trends towards bigness, as he said in that speech in Worthington, Minnesota in September of 1966, the forces of bigness come from many directions. It's corporate consolidation, it's control of a variety of aspects of life, and also the feeling of futility that individuals often have. Robert Kennedy pointed to the fact that that didn't have to be the case, and it didn't represent the best of the American tradition or really lead to fulfillment for individuals within their own lives. And the quote from the Worthington speech, which we both like so much, is, to these central dangers, we can trace 100 others in the signs around us that all is not well in the Republic. Spreading violence, unconcern for others, too many seeking escape in non-involvement or in drugs, debate become acerbic and bad-tempered, and overall a sense that no one is listening. And that affected his policy, not just his philosophy, so that in a direct action that he took in New York as senator in the pivotal effort to create the Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Corporation, he chose a form, a corporation that had not been used. He chose to involve the private sector significantly, state government, federal government, but most importantly, he insisted that the decision-making be done at the community level. And the notion was that communities understood best their problems and their priorities. And so if government was going to be effective in empowering and enhancing their abilities, it had to start first with what the people found critical in their own future.
there was so much brilliance packed into his promotion and creation of the community development corporations, and particularly the Bedford-Stuyvesant restoration effort, not the least of which was his realization that, you know, underlying everything and all of these problems was a lack of employment. That when we're not gainfully employed and able to care for our families, we're not connected to the fabric of our community. And in those CDCs, the really first public-private partnerships that government had been collaborating with private sector to launch, he was also creating jobs locally by the local engagement in rehabilitating these buildings from within the community. And it served as this model that many communities have benefited from for a number of years, and yet also seems to be forgotten sometimes when we still have communities like Baltimore with so many boarded up houses that could benefit from innovative partnership like this. It's frustrating when you're a reader and of this book and someone who is a public advocate for change. I'm like, oh, he's given us this roadmap, and yet we still have these problems.
A number of things I think are very significant in what you've said. Frustration is good. Frustration provokes change. It reminds us of our better selves and our better vision for America. I think frustration is best as a goad to action. And I think part of the reason that we're seeing so many op-ed pieces, television series, a whole lot of coverage about Robert Kennedy, is that that memory is provocative, and provocative in an inspirational way for action. Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Corporation exists today. It's made a difference in tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of lives, just that one instance. But the primacy of jobs, which you've correctly pointed out was the centerpiece really of his domestic policy, worked on a number of levels. He certainly understood the importance of it to macroeconomics, and on a family level to family stability and sustainability. But it was really the psychic value of work, the fact that people do define themselves by what they do, how they spend a significant portion of their day, and that one's ability to take care of oneself and one's family are critical to feeling connected. And when you feel that you have a stake, not only in making your family's life better, but you are connected to the broader efforts of your community and your country, then you are proud of what you are accomplishing, and you are part of the broader whole. And through all of that, you have all of the other benefits of community, which is realizing the common human aspirations we all have for ourselves and for our family, and being able to knit that together into a stronger fabric.
It's also very interesting to follow the path of Bobby Kennedy's own personal transformation through your book, because the man who we come to know as a United States senator and a presidential candidate in 64 to 68, where he's so focused on these issues of connection to community and bridging the divisions among us in race relations and breaking fast with Cesar Chavez and the farm workers, that wasn't the same Bobby Kennedy that was known in the late 50s and early 60s when he was on the Senate subcommittees doing the investigations of racketeering and organized labor. He was known as the law and order guy coming into the attorney general's office. And then his brother is killed. And through the arc of the life of Robert Kennedy, especially as you so beautifully wove it together with his own words and public speeches and the imprint he left on us through his service to this country, one gets a sense of the very personal transformation of this human character. Can you speak to us a little bit about that?
I think that's a profound observation. I have a slight twist on it. There's no question that Robert Kennedy matured through a variety of different things, through his own tragedy, through his own experience, particularly with marginalized communities, where not only had he not been there previously to his various trips, but most Americans had no idea how their fellow citizens were living. But I think there is also an element, of course it was the same Robert Kennedy, and the deep faith-based foundation for all of this was always present. I think Chris Matthews' book actually makes very valuable contributions in this respect. It's called Raging Spirit, and it came out in November, and it's a great biography. What Chris points out is that Robert Kennedy was deeply religious, deeply committed to the underdog, and those threads became stronger and applied more broadly as his own experience extended. But even in the time period where he first came to the public's attention here in the United States, going after mobsters and corrupt union leaders on the work on the Rackets Committee, he was tremendously tough. But I think he recognized politically that Americans always understand that they live in a scary world. And so they are looking for leaders who are tough. We talked a moment ago about the extent to which these problems that confront us are so enormous that they can be overwhelming. Toughness in your leadership is a great way of reminding us that there is a way to make a difference on this. I think also ridding corruption out of public life and the private sector, which is really what the Rackets Committee was about, is an important ingredient to having a functioning democracy so that you can begin to take care of these other problems. And he brought it together. He wrote a book after the Rackets Committee years called The Enemy Within. And near the end of it, there is quite an extraordinary comment. He says, "It seems to me imperative that we reinstill in ourselves the toughness and idealism that guided the nation in the past." So even at that point, book came out in 1960, he was writing it in 59, essentially during the campaign. Even then, he was weaving together toughness and idealism. And I think that that's an important part of his record, his example, and a pathway or playbook, as it were, for us who want to improve our country now.
Put into context the notion of toughness with Robert Kennedy in the 1960s and those who might support our current president, Trump, because they see him as having a certain kind of toughness. But these are two very different kinds of toughness. Robert Kennedy's toughness was often about a willingness to say difficult things and call people to their better angels when it was an unpopular opinion. But he had a certain moral center that forced him, pushed him, encouraged him to speak truth even when it was uncomfortable. That's a very different kind of toughness than what we're experiencing right now, would you say?
Bullies are never tough. And bullies exert force by punching down. Robert Kennedy was the antithesis of punching down. He consistently punched up. It's an authentic toughness when you sit as close as you and I are right now to someone who's literally killed people. And when you are pursuing them to put them behind bars where they belong, and when you know that that will result in personal threats on your life and on your children receiving telephone calls that say, "We know where you go to school. We are going to come and throw acid in your eyes. when you take on that kind of challenge because you believe the results are so important for your family and for the country, that's authentic toughness. And the way it played out in terms of running for office himself is, as you said, also important. He really believed in the old concept of the marketplace of ideas. And if we were going to get to a better future, we had to be guided by facts and by a pursuit of the truth rather than being certain that we possessed the truth. Mm-hmm. And so he deliberately sought out hostile audiences, and he deliberately confronted the comfortable, even though he understood, and particularly as a very superb campaign manager, that he was losing voters in doing so. Yeah. And so throughout the book, there are stories, whether it's abroad or at home, of him deliberately seeking out audiences who he knew would be utterly uncomfortable with his positions and with him, and where the attacks may be physical or may be verbal, but he thought the engagement was important, and particularly so, progress would be made if it was done with respect. And really, that is lost in much of today's political argument, with the impact of social media in driving many of us to kind of single source news. And that becomes pernicious to a democracy.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm particularly inspired by Robert Kennedy is the way in which he could take an issue and apply a certain level of mindfulness and consciousness to what was happening, and taking that with his willingness to go into a place of hostility and dissent really open a certain deeper level of awareness about the root cause of a situation. For example, when the riots were happening, he didn't just condemn the violence. He challenged the nation to have a deeper awareness and conversation about the underlying issues that were creating the riots. And so one place where this, there are many places where Kennedy has reflected this, but one place that I'd love for you to walk us through is the extemporaneous remarks that Robert Kennedy delivered to a rally gathered for him in Indianapolis on the night that Martin Luther King was assassinated.
I think it's worthwhile to tell the underlying story and then reflect on the points that you're making, because it was an extraordinary circumstance. When Dr. King was shot, we were obviously in an era without cell phones, without 24-hour news. And so while Senator Kennedy had been telephoned the news before he flew from his previous event to Indianapolis, most of the folks in Indianapolis and elsewhere were not yet aware. So when he arrived in Indianapolis, he was greeted by the mayor, Richard Lugar, who became senator, and by the police chief, whose name was Winston Churchill, quite extraordinarily. And they said, you have this rally in the biggest center of the African-American community in Indianapolis, in a neighborhood that is a challenge for us, for our police force to begin with. And under these circumstances, we cannot protect you, and we would recommend to you that you not attend the rally. Senator Kennedy turned to his advance man, John Lewis, who was already a civil rights icon, now a congressman. And he asked John, what do you think I should do? And Lewis's perspective was they had to go, that the community needed to hear from the best known white politician, the person to whom they felt most connected in power, at a time when they were going to be desperate. And so Kennedy said to the police chief, I could go to that park, I could pitch a tent, and my family and I could sleep there tonight, and we would not be harmed. If you cannot do that, that's your problem. So he sent his wife ahead to the hotel. She was pregnant. And when he and John Lewis took off, and in fact, the police escort peeled off at the edge of the community, and there was kind of no security support. It was a rally. People were in largely a festive mood, although at the back of the crowds, folks were coming in with tire irons and a bunch of other instruments that didn't suggest things would go well. And when you take a look at the video that we have on our website, rfkspeeches.com, the beginning of it, you can hear Kennedy asking, as he steps up on the flatbed truck that he'll be speaking from, asking the event organizers, do they know about Dr. King? And the answer was no. And so he broke the news, and you hear screams from the crowd. What followed were, as you said, entirely extemporaneous remarks. He had scribbled some notes on a piece of paper. You see him have a piece of paper in his hand. He never looked down. And what he tried to convey really touched on many of the principal elements that led to his own sense of what we are to be as humans and how we connect to one another and to your broader themes of Soul Force. First, he spoke entirely from the heart, but the language he used was extremely elevated. Robert Kennedy didn't believe in talking down to audiences, and that again is a big difference from the way folks in power tend to communicate today. He wanted to be authentic, but he believed that his audience had the same strivings that he himself had. And so you will hear in the course of those remarks him quote the Greek tragedian Aeschylus from almost 3,000 years ago. And very few modern politicians even know who Aeschylus is, much less can kind of quote him off the cuff. But the reason that Robert Kennedy remembered those lines so vividly is that they had been helpful to him in his own grief after his brother's death. That, too, was an important part of the authenticity and connection he made with that audience that night. It was one of the very first public mentions of his brother's death. And he talked about the impact of violence, not on a philosophical level, but on a deeply personal level, and said that he could understand why a community who had lost their leader would think about turning to violence, and that rage, revenge, a range of other negative emotions and actions were easy to come about in grief, but they were not productive on an individual level or on a community level. And so his call for nonviolence didn't come because he was a powerful government official recommending it to a community, but because he was someone who had grieved through the result of violence in his own life. And that capacity to connect with his own grief and emotion and apply it effectively in a conversation with others was a principal reason, I believe, and most historians believe, why Indianapolis was quiet that night when over 120 American cities were experiencing rioting. 39 people died. Hundreds were injured. Tens of millions of dollars of property damage. And so Indianapolis stood out as an example of how the most tragic of circumstances can be overcome if thought about in a unique way, and if basic human emotions can be accessed with authenticity and leadership.
Thank you for that.